So I'm going to talk about what happens after oligarchy. And I'm looking at the final stages of the planets. And specifically, I'll focus on two sets of planets, the terrestrial ones, Venus, Earth, and Mars, and on the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune. And I won't talk about Jupiter and Saturn because they contain lots of gas, and that complicates the picture. So let's look in more detail at the observations. One thing to know from the observations is that the planets are very far separated when you measure in terms of the Hill radius. And just to remind you, the Hill radius is the size of an imaginary sphere around each planet, inside of which the gravity of the planet is more important than the gravity of the Sun. So at first sight, it's surprising that they're separated so far apart. After all, as they're accreting, how did they manage to accrete material that was midway between them? How did it find its way onto the planet if the gravity of the planet is that important? A second observationally related fact, observationally derived fact, is that the planetary system is marginally stable. And this gives a hint to what the answer to the first question is gonna, first problem is. So by marginally stable, if you add another planet to almost anywhere in the solar system, it'll destabilize the system, and one of the planets will either collide or be ejected. A third observational fact, which is well known, is that the planetary system is very cold. The eccentricities and inclinations are very small. The questions I'm going to try to answer is, first of all, when does oligarchy end, and what happens next? And the answer to that question will hopefully lead us to answer the next three questions, which is, what sets the spacing between the planets? Why is it so large in terms of hill radii? Why are they circular and coplanar? And how long did it take them to form? So before going beyond oligarchy, I'll say what oligarchy is. So this is from a simulation of Kokubo and Ida. And this is an n-body simulation where they start off with many small equal mass bodies, as might have been the case in the early solar nebula. So this is the initial, this is at early times, the x-axis is a semi-major axis, the y-axis is eccentricity, and then the size of the dot is proportional to the size of the body. They start off with many planets, and as you evolve, you very quickly enter this phase of runaway growth, where a few bodies grow much bigger than everybody else because their gravity field focuses more and more bodies onto their surface. But that phase of growth, where a few bodies get very big, eventually stalls out, and you end up with a second phase, which they called oligarchy. In oligarchy, all the big bodies, have roughly comparable masses, and the bodies are separated by a few Hill spheres. And this is a slower growing phase, and it gradually continues. The bodies grow slowly, eat more and more small bodies in this phase. So it's natural to suppose that our solar system is just the end state of oligarchy. After the big bodies have eaten all the small ones, then you just end up, that would be our solar system. This clearly can't be the case, because in oligarchy, the oligarchs are just separated by a few Hill radii. And so this is whereas Earth and Venus, for example, are separated by 30 Hill radii, and Uranus and Neptune are by 15 Hill radii. So that can't be the solution. It has to be something after oligarchy. So let's take a closer look at the physical processes that are occurring during oligarchy. There are essentially two types of processes. One is accretion, where they're big bodies and they're small bodies. The small bodies are just accreted onto the big bodies. And the big bodies grow at this rate, given by a product of two terms. One is just the geometric factor, assuming there's no gravity between the big bodies and small ones. And another is a gravitational focusing factor. And the important point to note here is that U is the speed, the random speed of the small bodies. If you make U very small, accretion can happen very fast. But U is not a free parameter that you can adjust. U is set by the next important physical process, which is heating and cooling. So the second process, heating and cooling, the oligarchs are very efficient at heating everything up. They heat things up by viscous stirring, by which their gravity field can deflect all the other particles, and that transforms the Keplerian shear into random motion. And this heating is very fast. It's much faster than accretion. So heating and cooling very nearly balance each other as the oligarchs grow. So let's do this balance for the small bodies, heating and cooling, because we want to calculate what U is, what the speed of the small bodies is. We balance heating and cooling, and we get the speed of the small bodies. And the important point to note here is that it depends on S, the size of the small bodies. If the small bodies are very small, there's lots of surface area in the small bodies. They're very efficient at damping things. So small S means small U. small s means small u, and from the previous slide, that means fast accretion. So the point of this is that if, as long as s is very small, you can get very fast formation. And this can for realistic cases, it's quite possible that Uranus and Neptune formed quite quickly, in under 20 million years, as long as s is small. And it's quite likely that s is small because of collisional breakup. S is the radius of the small bodies. S, the radius of the small bodies. The size of the small bodies. How small is small? Okay, so the next thing, which is even more interesting, is if instead we look at, if first we did the balance on the small bodies, but now let's do the heating and cooling balance on the big bodies. So on the big bodies, the heating is again done by viscous stirring, but now the cooling is done by dynamical friction from the small bodies. Whereas on the small body, the cooling was done by inelastic collisions amongst themselves. So let's do the balance, the heating and cooling balance for the big bodies. This is the heating, viscous stirring. This is cooling, dynamical friction. And the outcome we get is that V, the random speed of the big bodies, is equal to U, the random speed of the small bodies, times the ratio of the sigmas. And the sigma is just the surface mass density. So big sigma is in the big bodies, little sigma is in the small bodies. In this formula, I was assuming that V is less than U. So there's less mass in the big bodies than the small bodies. The reason why this is interesting is look what happens when the two sigmas are equal, when half the mass is in the big bodies. Then the velocities in the big bodies and the small bodies are the same. So in the dynamical friction formula, this is the dynamical friction formula, dynamical friction is caused by the small bodies moving relative to the big bodies and slowing them down. But now the relative speed between big bodies and small bodies is no longer U, but it's V, because V is bigger than U, as soon as there's more mass in the big bodies and small bodies. So this U is replaced by a V. And so these two focusing factors are the same. The heating and cooling focusing factors are both the same. So this term, the heating term, always wins. As soon as the masses in the big bodies are the same as the mass in the small bodies, heating runs away. You can no longer balance heating by cooling. The big bodies just stir each other up to higher and higher speeds. Yes?
This formula with e to the fourth power saturates when you get below a kilowatt.
Yes, that's a good point, and thanks for asking that. So before I said that U had to be very small. And so this is true. The formula changes by ratios of the Hill velocity to U. But it doesn't change the conclusion. You can go through the same argument, and you have exactly the same conclusion.
You are also saying heating is if the big bodies are separated.
Right. Well, this is during oligarchy, where the big bodies are separated by the feeding zones. So the size of the feeding zone is set by this, the feeding zone is the same size as the heating zone. So the heating runs away. So starting off with this situation, the big bodies jump out of the disk. What happens next? Heating just continues. Things get hotter and hotter. And they can heat each other up all the way up to the escape speed of the big bodies. And it's inevitable. There's no way to avoid it. So what happens next is different from the inner solar system and the outer solar system. So let's first look at the outer solar system. The important difference is when you look at the escape speed to the orbital speed. So in the outer solar system, the escape speed from the oligarchs at the end is larger than the orbital speed around the sun. So if they try to heat each other up, if the big bodies try to heat each other up to their escape speed, some of them just fly out of the solar system. And they're just lost, or maybe they end up in the Oort cloud. As soon as that happens, as soon as you lose some big bodies, viscous stirring goes down. Even if viscous stirring goes down by a little bit, and cooling wins. And so the remaining bodies get cooler and cooler. And eventually you end up with cooler bodies. And you could have a repeating cycle. Once the big bodies get cool, they accrete more small bodies. The system destabilizes itself. Some bodies are ejected, etc. Realistically, though, in the outer solar system, Uranus and Neptune are only separated by around 15 Hill radii. So there are probably only two or three planets between them that were ejected. So this whole thing might have only happened once. No, you don't. This the reason that you don't eject them is the small bodies collide with each other very frequently. It turns out that there's actually the problem. Well, in this story, you need the small bodies to stay around after around a billion years to keep the big bodies cool after they're ejected. It turns out a bigger problem is not how to keep the small bodies around. A bigger problem is how to get rid of them. And so this will be Ram's talk on Thursday, was how to get rid of them. But it's very difficult to get rid of them because they collide so frequently.
So they collide, but they don't coagulate. Is that what you're saying?
Well, this would be a topic of Ram's talk, but certainly they don't coagulate because things depend, but they could collide. They could break each other up. They could break each other up to smaller pieces. Ram will go into more detail about the small bodies.
Then the problem is, why don't we see enormous amount of differentiated meteorites versus chondrules? I mean, chondrules are most of the remnants that we see from meteorites. And if this story is true, don't we expect a lot of differentiated meteorites in fractional lines compared to chondrules?
You have to get them in.
I guess what they assume is that this third is smaller than this, like millimeter size or something, which are not differentiated. But
the point is that unless you can only keep them at one kilometer size, if there's a continuous process, you're eroding and coagulating at the same time, they're bound to get over this fractionated size, right? They gotta be broken down and fractionated. So why is it that we see so few meteorites that are remnants, fractional-wise, are remnants of fractionated?
Well, but
fractionated parent body.
It's a different story. What happens in for the asteroid belt? This is in the outer solar system. In the asteroid belt, they could have, I'm not really sure what exactly happened, but it could have been that there were just a bunch of differentiated bodies that were just collided by Jupiter.
But Jupiter just not differentiated bodies, because we see a whole bunch, I mean, by and large, the asteroids, the meteorites we see from the asteroid belt are carbonaceous chondrules. Their parent body could not have been very big, otherwise they would have been differentiated. I mean, by this story, then we would expect a lot of remnants of the fraction, of the broken up material, which has once been pretty big, that have been able to differentiate.
But I don't see why you're saying that all this small material was originally quite big. The small material, if you start off with, okay.
Yeah, all I'm saying is that if you went through a process of equilibrium, collisional equilibrium, mm-hmm. you must have gone big and then small, big and
no,
small.
No, it's not clear that things would get bigger.
A small population
and then they stay small. They stay small because they don't coalesce. Yes?
Well, if it's mean, I'd like to respond to Doug. Doug, the only place we really have the sample
is in the asteroid. I understand, but why is the asteroid belt so special compared to anywhere else? I mean, if this story is not...
Because the area was good.
Sorry.
Did you want to ask a question? No, you might as well ask.
No, the problem that I see I think what you're saying is that that when these things, the small ones hit each other, pull them off, mm-hmm. they grind themselves down.
Exactly.
So
they get smaller and smaller. The small bodies get smaller and smaller. And so it seems that they just go to infinitesimal size, and they just get a really cool disk. What happened? I don't want to give away Ram's talk, but it could be that you have a gravitational instability in this disk. You can reform small bodies, but he'll have this in more detail.
A lot of it is dust. It's blown
out. It can't get blown out because the optical depth is extremely high in this material. If it's all in small bodies, the light won't go through it. It's not an optically thin system. There's lots of stuff here. Still lots of matter.
It's stuck in the movie and
want to see how the story comes out.
Okay. Okay. So to go back to where we are in the story, a few of the big bodies have left. The remaining big bodies have been cooled by the small ones. And this process can continue until the big bodies don't eat each other anymore, until there's no large-scale chaos. And so that would be why we tend to the solar system, which is a marginally chaotic system. So this was for Uranus and Neptune. And let's go to Venus, Earth, and Mars. So Venus.
Before you go to Venus, can you tell us when does the gas get on Uranus and Neptune?
Yeah. So in this, strictly speaking, I'm just neglecting gas. For Uranus and Neptune, there's not much gas in them. So
yeah,
there's only 10%, around 10%.
But
so
it must get there at some point.
Right. But it probably, since there's so little, it's reasonable to expect that it happened after most of the gas was gone.
Fred's making an official point here, because if you grind things down while there's still gas there, it just it normal decays and you clean up the region.
Right. So this process would have to happen after the dust starts, after the gas goes away. Sorry.
But there you have the contradiction, because if it happens after the gas goes away, you can't trap a few Earth masses of gas.
Well, you have something.
Yeah, you
can. Why don't you let Europe continue?
Roman could talk about that.
Well, just to answer your question, you could have some gas left over. It turns out, actually, that for forming, I didn't go over in detail into timescales, but for forming Uranus and Neptune, the bottleneck, the thing that takes the longest time, is the first collision. If you start off with roughly bodies that are roughly kilometer size, then just to start a runaway growth in Uranus and Neptune region takes 20 million years. After that, things go quite fast, and especially since things almost certainly grind themselves down, so things go faster and faster. So the whole process probably doesn't take much longer than 20 million years.
Well, actually, if the first collision of the runaway body is the problem, then Stu White actually has probably solved the problem, because he's shown that you'll get well before that things thrown out into that region, which would be dynamic by dynamical friction. Things which grew because they were a lot closer to the sun, thrown out there, slowed by dynamical friction. It's a smaller version than Thomas et al.
Let's go on, because this too, I guess, we'll have a chance to talk about this period.
So the second case is the Earth. And for the Earth, it might be more problematic to neglect gas, but it's the simplest thing to do. In the Earth system, the escape speed being less than the orbital speed means that nothing can be ejected. Everything that we see here, everything that was originally there had to stay there. It just couldn't be ejected. So everything can collide with everything else, and the time scale for a collision is quite fast. It's around 100 million years. And so this is quite similar to the simulation by Chambers and others, which shows that if you start off in an after-oligarchic phase, when you have a small number of quite big bodies, they collide and they form a system that looks sort of like the inner solar system, except their bodies are, Dave said, they have high eccentricities. But as soon as the bodies get separated, so they no longer chaotically hit each other, there'll still be some residual small bodies, and just left over from the beginning. And you only need a small number, because once the big bodies no longer hit each other, the small bodies have a long time to act, and they can just cool everything down. So in a sense, we have the opposite problem of not why the eccentricities are so big, but why aren't they so small? It seems like they should just cool, be extremely cool, just the eccentricities equal zero.
How much of the amount of it is small for
you? At the end, it's very uncertain. This I can't tell you. You need a very small amount. I can tell you how much you need.
It is a small amount, and you cannot cool down the
right. But once the big bodies are sufficiently separated, they no longer chaotically heat each other. Then there's no more heating. So it's just all you're left with is cooling.
You need to have this initial energy, which was a burden.
Right, right, but it's just continually cooling. It's just a one-way street.
No, but you're going to get rid of the small bodies by the big bodies. If you have less than several percent, you're not going to, the mass, you're not going to be able to do it.
And well, the question is how small are the small, if the small bodies are very small, they're very difficult to get rid of.
You're saying that there's so many small bodies that they have a high optical depth and they can't be excited.
Well, not as high, it doesn't have to be high compared to one.
Because they'll collide before and damp before they're...
Right. They're not high compared to one, but they just have to be...
Well, won't those collisions produce dust before you blow them out?
Well, the... Again, it's the same as before. It's harder if the, well, it depends how high the...
You don't have that much material.
Well, this is now a significant amount of the, you mean there's not much material now, or there wasn't much material originally? This is now a significant fraction of the original material. So we're just saying a significant fraction of the original material is in dust. And it's hard, if it's all in dust, you can't blow it out.
But what about the embryos just shepherd the dust later?
This is RAM... Ram will talk about this in detail. They will talk about shepherding. They'll make gaps.
Write it down. Keep
laughing about this guy.
Okay, so there will be gaps. So
is it possible to ask Ram to talk after the coffee? Are you ready for
it? If
you're not so we'll have Jack volunteers. Jack volunteers. So we just move Jack.
Okay. So let me answer the questions that I asked at the beginning. When does oligarchy end, and what happens next? When the two sigmas are equal, and this is regardless of whether the speed, the u, is bigger than the Hill velocity or less than the Hill velocity. When the two sigmas are equal, the heating runs away, and this is an inevitable conclusion. That's when oligarchy ends. So now, that's the remaining questions. What sets the spacing between the planets? It's just stability. The solar system is marginally stable, so there's no large-scale chaos. Why are they circular and coplanar? Because you just need a small number of small bodies remaining, a small mass in small bodies, but a lot of surface area, to damp the velocities. And finally, how long does it take them to form? For Uranus, let's first talk about the outer solar system, Uranus and Neptune. For Uranus and Neptune, it's quite likely that it's after oligarchy, once the chaotic heating begins, after that there's no more accretion of the small bodies. And then the time for them to form is just the time to end oligarchy. And that, as I said, can be quite fast as long as things grind themselves, as long as the small bodies remain cold. There is a problem is that the Uranus and Neptune aren't the ice, they don't have the mass of the isolation mass, they're a little bit bigger. So to get to Uranus and Neptune, you have to boost the mass of the minimum mass solar nebula by a factor of about 6 to get to Uranus and Neptune. And so it takes them, they can form very fast before all the gas disappears, which is roughly 10 million years. But it takes them much longer to eject themselves. It takes around a billion years to eject, and this has been shown in simulations. To eject things to the Oort cloud, it takes around a billion years. In the inner solar system, where the formation time is not set by the end of oligarchy. The formation time is set by the collisions between the bodies, as in Chambers simulation. And since everything's heated itself up to the escape speed, it's just set by physical collisions. And that time is just 100 million years. All right, thank you.
I'm sure there will be a lot of questions over here. I don't know, this may be in support of your talk, but if you look at the separation between the inner solar system, in terms of Hill radii, it looks quite large. But if you take the escape velocity divided by the circular velocity to get an eccentricity, they're separated essentially by r times the eccentricity. So that says that the big body stirred things up to give them the eccentricity equal to their escape velocity. And then you clean out a much bigger annulus.
Right. I think that's similar, for example, to why Chambers sees his result, where he gets three planets in the end. Venus, well, they have the right to the same size because the epicycles are around the separation.
Okay, so the picture that I'm getting here is that the oligarchic bodies you grow are already close to Neptune size. Is that what you're saying?
For the outer solar system, for Uranus and Neptune, yes.
And you have maybe how many of them in the beginning?
Five. They're now separated by 15 Hill radii, so if they're separated by a few Hill radii, they're five.
Okay. And so the first thing I would wonder is, when you have this kind of situation, what keeps these from, you know, during their original scattering, from not sort of spreading out like a like diffusion?
So you're saying before the velocity has gone above?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, there should also be some random walk in there, some major axes, and the tendency is to sort of spread out this group of...
Well, there's a whole system, but...
I'm worried with just leaving two. I mean, because there's also a tendency for them to space themselves and try to get stability that way. And they could use the small particles to do this. Yeah.
So there will be some spreading. You can calculate how long it takes to spread out. It's essentially since the bodies are separated by around a Hill velocity, essentially one synodic time at the Hill velocity, two guys will be separated, will tend to get a kick. But the spreading time is only comparable to the growth time at the very end. So if you look at earlier times when there are lots of bodies, there's just so many of them, there's not much diffusion. But at late times, it becomes comparable.
Right.
But it's only comparable, so... So I don't expect there'll be much spreading.
I'd like to comment on the oligarchy. I think that the point of oligarchy is big bodies are well separated. You mentioned the separation distance, a few Hill radii, but the N-body distribution, our calculation shows a separation distance about 10 Hill radii or something like that.
Right. Well, the essential point is the speed of the small bodies. So in oligarchy, the bodies should be separated by their feeding zone. You can, two big bodies that enter to the same feeding zone, with feeding zone, I mean they can both eat a certain number of planetesimals. They can begin to accrete each other. They begin to affect each other. So in the simulation, you get around 10 Hill radii because the eccentricities of the bodies are around the eccentricities of the bodies are around 10 Hill velocities. So the eccentricity of the small body is around 10 Hill velocity. So a small body can go from one big body to another. This is similar to what you were saying. Mm-hmm. So the zone when it's 10 Hill velocity, the size should be around 10 Hill radii, but in our case, when we're saying that the velocities are almost certainly very small because of collisional grinding, and the velocities are small, I think it's much more likely they'll be separated only by a few Hill radii. And this, I don't think this has been checked well in numerical simulations, but it's something that's worthwhile checking. But if the velocity is very small, the feeding zone is very small, and I'd expect they'll be much closer separated, a few Hill radii rather than 10.
So you think that there's this problem of small bodies are very, very small?
If it's very small, it'll go. The separation will come closer together.
Mm-hmm.
More questions?
Well, I mean, as usual, Bill Ward messes up the story a little bit, because if you migrate, you can easily migrate a few Hill radii, and therefore, when you eat up everything in your feeding zone, you go into a fresh feeding zone.
So you're saying the big bodies when they...
No, not that big. I mean, bodies of even Mars size, type 1 migration, which is very fast.
But during the stage of oligarchic growth, when you have many, many, let's say, Mars-ish sized bodies, as they grow, they're not going to diffuse across each other. They're always well separated by the Hill sphere. They can't jump across the neighboring big body.
No, I'm just saying they migrate because of the many nebulae.
Oh, because of gas.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So this is
after much gas. I mean, gas comparable to the bodies, which for observers would say we've gotten rid of the gas. Actually, I don't even know when you get rid of the gas. You know when they got rid of the dust. But I don't think there are any good markers on how long the gas lasts.
Well, it's thought that it's around 10 million years because of the dust, because the dust is so clean.
That's right.
But if you get rid of a significant...
That may not be true, but that's what's thought.
But if there's not a significant amount of gas, then you won't get a significant amount of gas migration.
The same amount of gas as in rocks would be an insignificant amount of gas.
But that won't give you migration, though.
It'll slow it down. Slow it down by a factor of four.
I mean, if you're talking about migrating the distance.
Yeah, it's not time to go.
You say even if there's 1% of the original gas
no,
left?
No, no. I mean, 20%, 10%.
So it's...
I mean, those times are so fast with heat catastrophe that you cut the gas down by 10%, it's still a problem.
It's about I have to check. Yeah, all the time, it's slower. Even the migration is slower, everything else.
Okay, I got the floor. I got the mic anyway. These timescales are pretty long. Is there any problems in terms of forming Jupiter? Do you have any problems of getting Jupiter in before the gas goes away?
So which time? Are you talking about now the Earth?
Well, I mean, you know, in the conventional core accretion scenario, usually people require several Earth mass of core to be formed, let's say before the gas goes away.
No, but Jupiter could have formed quite fast. It could have formed by, it didn't have to wait this long time. The only reason for this long time is because the bodies were stirred up, so there's no more gravitational focusing. So you can only count on physical collisions.
So the different parts of the solar system had many different way of growing, is that
well, for,
in this
so
picture?
For Jupiter and Saturn, I don't know in detail, so I haven't looked at it enough.
Okay.
Yes, what your means is that basically in the inner solar system, the isolation mass is too small to constitute the final mass of the planet, while in the region of the outer solar system, you know, it can be as high as masses over the course of...
No, but really what I mean is that the reason you get this 100 million years is because if it's similar to what you were saying. If you split Earth into two, then those two halves will just heat each other up to their escape speed. There's no escaping that. They have to heat each other up. Once they're heated up to their escape speed, it's trivial to calculate what the time for them to collide is. It's just the physical collision. Essentially, it's just the optical depth of Earth times the orbit time. And the optical depth of Earth times the orbit time, right, divided, one over that, is 100 million years.
If there's no gravitational focus.
But there can't be, because they heat each other up.
That's why the Safronov's analytic time scale, we have low gravitational focus, they are what Wetherill Chambers, Agnar, and everybody else find.
Right.
You need low gravitational focus.
Have you had a chance to look at the paper by Inaba and Wetherill, which was just published a year or so ago, where they did a multi-zone particle-in-the-box accretion code in the outer solar system?
Okay.
So they had a whole fragmentation tail, just like you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But what they find is that the velocities of the small bodies get elevated enough pretty quickly on the lifetime of the nebula, so that they spiral in to the inner solar system and drain out the system. I'm just wondering why that doesn't happen on the time scale.
Well, this would depend crucially on the size of the small bodies. The size of the small bodies sets the collision rate. So do you remember what their size of the small bodies was?
I think they were starting with something like comets.
So that's still quite big in what we consider big and small. So a kilometer is barely on the border. The time scale for kilometer-sized bodies to collide in the outer solar system is around 20 million years. This is related to the 20 million years I said before. If you get it much below comet size, then things will collide very frequently in the 20 million years that takes this process to happen. So as long as it's very small, then things will stay, will just jiggle around without being able to go very far.
As long as there's no radiation.
There won't be, if you're looking at the sun through this thick disk, it won't. This thick disk will block it. Through the disk, the optical depth is going to be very high.
Minimal excitation, initiation.
But it'll excite everything. But the whole disk is going to be excited. You have to blow away the whole disk. So step by step, you have to blow away the whole disk.
Yeah,
and that takes a long time. You can add up how many optical depths there are, and it takes a long time.
So how large a terrestrial planet can you have, or how large an ice giant can you have in the story? What sets the maximum mass?
Well, it's set by the initial surface density. So in this picture, in the inner solar system, all the mass went into the planets. So in other words, the initial mass was the minimum mass of a nebula. In the other case, where you kicked some bodies out, let's say there were four, just for even numbers. There were originally, between Uranus and Neptune, there were four planets there. Two were kicked out. You'd say there has to be twice as much. There would have to be the minimum, the surface density originally would have to be twice of what it is today, but then another factor of two, because half the mass, when this excitation started, half the mass was in small bodies, so it would be about a factor of four. So the original surface mass had to be a factor of four or five, maybe, above the original. Does that answer your question? So
when you calculate the sort of ongoing decrease in size of these small bodies, because I take it they're getting smaller and smaller with time, mm-hmm.
Faster and faster. It goes faster. It's a cascade.
Do you have in that calculation the fact that the specific energy that you need to disrupt these objects, once they get small, they're actually becoming tougher to break up as they get smaller? Is that in there?
No. It's difficult to estimate how much tougher it is. So there's no detailed calculation. Again, I'd prefer to defer this to Ram.
Okay.
We don't have any comparison size. Just assume some size. We're asking what the size we need in order to take it.
I could say one thing, though, that the Hill speed, if you look at this Hill speed of Uranus and Neptune, which is any body that passes within a Hill radius, is hundreds of meters a second. You're talking about ice moving 100 meters per second. It's very difficult to believe that it won't, when they collide, it doesn't smash itself to the very small pieces.
I wanted to make a comment about this very important question of when the gas is lost, because a couple of other people had already brought this up. There's a tendency for people to think of it as gas present, gas absent. But that's not a good way to think about it, because if I lower the density of the nebula by two orders of magnitude, I can still accumulate gas onto a 10 Earth mass object. So, for example, you don't have to make Uranus with its component of gas at the time that the nebula was anywhere near its peak density. You can do it much later. And the reason is that the hydrostatically equilibrated gas that is accumulated around an embryo is only logarithmically sensitive to the nebula density. So I can change it by orders of magnitude, and I don't change the answer very much. Of course, if I go to really low values, then there's the question of the time to actually accrete the gas. But that's very low values. And to me, this raises the very important question that I wish people would pay more attention to, and that is, what is the actual physical process of losing the gas? Because in some models, like Hollenbach's models, it's not an exponential decline, it's actually a catastrophic drop from some finite value to zero. And that's very different from some model where you thought that you were eating away the gas and you had some sort of exponential tail of gas. So I hope people pay attention to that question. I realize it's very difficult observationally, but it is an important question.
Another question. Now, the point at where oligarchy ends, okay, I asked you, does that mean like you already have Neptune-sized objects?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that that would depend on sort of the number of sort of nucleation sites that you imagine you have, because you can't grow all the way to Neptune size if you have a neighboring object that is competing with you.
Well, so I'm not sure I follow. If you start with the n-body simulation, you do a simulation, and you end up with big bodies that are separated by Hill radii, and the big bodies grow. Well, there's a question of whether it's a few Hill radii or 10 Hill radii. But that roughly they're separated by, let's say, a few Hill radii. Right. The big bodies grow, their Hill radii grow, their separation increases. So I'm just saying at the end of that, you end up with Uranus here and Neptune here, and they're separated by...
Well, what I'm getting at is what are the size of the objects which are actually, controlling the dynamics. And so I'm wondering what, for instance, I can imagine a case where you use up all the, you get down to half the material are in small objects and half the material are large objects, but you have a lot of large objects, not just five.
You're saying the total mass is the same in both?
Yeah. That, in other words, you had enough competing objects that they, interfere with each other, and at some point in this history, before you get to the point you want to get to, you have most of the mass, more than half the mass, is bound up into maybe 1,000 kilometer size objects, and that these now begin to heat each other.
So are you having three sets of bodies? You have the big 1,000 kilometer and small?
No.
Are you saying?
No, I just have two. I just have 1,000 kilometer sized embryos that have depleted the small body population enough that they can begin to heat each other and go into crossing orbits. And so now you have pretty large impacts going on.
Well, given the minimum mass, given the initial surface density that you start with, you can ask, what is the isolation mass? What is the mass of the bodies when they've eaten? Usually it's in terms of they've eaten everything. It's roughly whether they've eaten half or everything.
Yeah, I know that.
The isolation mass is just Neptune.
Well, I know that, but that doesn't mean that you don't have an intermediate, an earlier period of time when the bodies don't know what their final mass is going to be. So they have neighbors that are competing with them, and they're coexisting. And although eventually they're going to combine in some manner, okay, they may combine with large impacts rather than.
Well, at this point, so at early times, there's going to be less mass than the big bodies, because at the end is when I say the end happens when there's equal mass. So earlier, there must be less mass in the big bodies. At this point...
No. No. I'm not talking about Neptune-sized bodies. Let's say at some point, what precludes at some point you having more than half of the total amount of material locked up into neighboring 1,000-kilometer-sized objects, which begin to perturb each other? Well, how do you avoid that?
You're saying when the two sigmas are equal, you end up with that situation.
Yeah.
Oh, so how you avoid that's just set by the initial mass density, because that's what sets the isolation mass. So your 1,000 kilometers is yes the.
Okay. Let's talk later.
We're gonna go back and forth.
Okay.
I mean, ideally, your system you move planets and dust.
But there are asteroids. There are Kuiper Belt objects. There are Pluto-sized bodies. Okay, these bodies do exist. You cannot ignore them, and they have an effect in your disk.
Well, they're not going to affect the formation of Uranus and Neptune. It's true. It's a very interesting question of what happens to them, and I've completely ignored it. But it's a difficult question, and I know you've addressed it. Well.
I'd like to know your typical orbital separation. So you assume in your calculation, orbital separation of big bodies.
It's not really a calculation, I should say.
Oh, yes, I know.
This is it.
But the result of n-body calculations. Mm-hmm. So yes, in the result, we have about 10 Hill radii separation. But this is nothing to do with the size of the feeding zone.
But I think that if you look at the feeding zone in the simulations, they are going to be, I have looked at the papers, they are 10 Hill radii. So it is, I think it is set by the size of the feeding zone. And
I checked. The same calculation with small eccentricities. But as long as the eccentricities are small enough for the dynamical friction to be effective, The orbital separation is mainly determined by the two-body interaction, two-body scattering between large bodies. Mm-hmm. And after the scattering, the dynamical friction dumps the eccentricity. So this orbital separation is nothing to do with the feeding zone.
Is this with only two big bodies?
Bodies, over three or four.
Well,
yeah.
With just a few, they can repel each other. Uh-huh. But if you have many, there's no place to repel. There's just no place for them to go. So I'd like to see if I'd like to see this simulation. I guess I'd have to look at more carefully before I could judge.
Well, ejection is not possible. Well, it's, you know, orbital separation is enough large. I mean, more than 10 qubit. I will show you tomorrow my my calculation.
Okay, good.
Yeah, we'll be charged. Well, I don't do that.
The thing I wasn't sure about what you said is that Ed Thomas did calculations on holographic growth, how long here in the and he never got anything as long as yours, and that's how the holographic growth.
Right.
So are you saying there's some physics in what you're thinking that he didn't have?
I wouldn't say physics, but I'd say the main difference is the size of the small bodies. His small bodies were big, so they weren't lots of physical collisions, so the velocities weren't dense. So it just took him so long, so the time scales were so long, because the velocities of the small bodies were so high, there was essentially very little gravitational focusing. If you just decrease the size of the small bodies, there would be a lot more collisions, things will be closer, things will go faster.
But by what factor?
Well, so for the time scale, well, I have actually, this was in one of the slides. If you look at how long it takes Uranus and Neptune to form with no gravitational focusing, so for Earth it was 100 million years. This is the same 100 million years I had before. For Uranus and Neptune, it's 1,000 billion years. So if there's no collisions, this is really the reason why the simulations are so difficult. You have to get it down from 1,000 billion years to, even if you want it to 5 billion years, you have to get the small bodies down to kilometer size. If you want it down to 20 million years, the small bodies have to be even smaller. Meter size.
Can I just say something about this? Been doing some simulations which try to mimic some of these oligarchic growth simulations that people have been doing in the past, but we've actually included an effect of actually reducing the sizes of the bodies as the simulation proceeds in time. So we do indeed have this sort of cooling of the planetesimals as the simulation goes on. But what we find is that the oligarchs are extremely good at shepherding the remaining planetesimals in the system and form gaps such that they rather become isolated from the planetesimal distribution, and you know, within a few million years you find that the accretion stops. Well, at the final stage of this particular picture, you're talking about having four or five oligarchs in the system, aren't you? So they're quite well separated.
Well, when they're at this stage, they're still separated by a few Hill radii. Once they're ejected, they're separated by more Hill radii, and there will be some shepherding.
How massive are they at the stage when you've only got a few objects in the system in your picture?
Well, they're not changing their mass. After oligarchy ends, they don't accrete much more. So they're roughly Uranus-Neptune mass throughout the stage.
Okay. Well, I've never seen anything get to anything like a Uranus. Well, the only way that the material can get through the gap, of course, if you're exciting the eccentricities, but you're saying that...
Questions and why don't we discuss all these remaining issues and technical details over there at the coffee and cookies? And for now, let's just thank Yoram again for very stimulating and interesting talk. Yeah, Jack.